This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to the August 31st, 2020 For Your Benefit radio show. We're here today with Maureen Wilkin. Maureen is a federal benefits officer, retired, and fortunately, we work together at NITP providing counsel, if you will, but more so the seminars. So good morning, Maureen.
Good morning, Bob. Hope all is well with you in this wonderful world we're in.
Well, all is good so far. For the next hour, I'm in good shape listening to you. So there are an awful lot of factors that employees need to consider but maybe don't know what to consider when they're preparing for retirement. And you've got, again, boots-on-the-ground knowledge of your career was counseling people and knowing the law first and counseling second. And then after that was over, you joined us, and we do retirement seminars. So in your travels, so to speak, what would you say are some major points that people need to consider but don't know to consider?
Well, I always emphasize records. Records, records, records. Records are the final frontier when it comes to your retirement benefit. And many people sort of put those on autopilot, and they don't pay attention. They don't pay attention to those messages they get from their agencies that say, we process the personnel action. Your copy is online. Go retrieve it. Or they distribute a hard copy. Employees need to be keeping those. Those are critical in terms of how their retirement will be calculated, in terms of their changes in pay and their creditable service. Right now, employees have access to those records either electronically or through hard copy. At this point, I'd say at least 90% are electronic. So they need to be keeping their own hard copies of that, or they can simply do a download to a thumb drive and put them on a thumb drive. But they should have a replica of their entire employment history with the federal government, because once they separate, they're going to lose access to those records. And so many people are ignorant of that fact at this point in time. So no matter where you are in your federal career, you should be aiming toward that, to have a replica of your official personnel folder at this point. So even if you should separate before you reach retirement, you'll have those records, and those are key to returning to federal service if you have a break and then return, to establish what your position was, what your pay was. Even more importantly, what was your sick leave balance, because that'll be restored if you have a break and return to service. So all of those things are key. So you should keep them as you're working through your history, and then as you get closer to retirement, they become key into determining your benefit. And then you'll have a good resource to go back to check the accuracy of those estimates you're receiving, because all of those are based on whatever is in your OPF. Now, if you change agencies, those records may not follow you. So you should be always be mindful. Check your OPF to make sure it's complete and it is accurate at any point in your career.
What's OPF mean again? Sorry, I can't write
for this. Your official personnel folder. Years ago, they were all kept hard copy and big electrievers, but most of them have been digitized, and they're available online to employees. And if they don't know how to access that, contact your HR function, ask a colleague. Each agency does it a little bit differently, but everyone has access to those same records that you're creating as you work through your career.
How far out should somebody make sure that they have everything that's in this OPF? Does it a month before?
At least 5 years out. And then all throughout your career, make sure everything is in there. Make sure it's complete. Even if you work summer jobs with federal service, or you work through college, or maybe you even were a letter carrier at the holidays for the Postal Service, all of that should be documented in your folder. So that's key throughout your history. It's just like making sure your records match for Social Security at the end of the year to what shows at your statement. It's the same idea. You want to make sure your employment history is complete and it's accurate.
When you address the pre-retirement groups and the mid-career groups, and I'm sure you talk about this, are you surprised that there isn't a knowledge of what's in that OPF?
Oh, definitely. People have no clue. They'll ignore their messages they'll get from their HR function or payroll or whatever, and they just assume everything is there. Never assume. That's when you get into trouble. So always check it. Check it at least once a year. A good time to check it is when you're doing your open season events for your health benefits, your life, your online entries. Go back and check your OPF to make sure that everything related to your employment history is accurate and complete as well. So it's a good timeline. During open season, go back and check your OPF too. They're not joined in any way, but it's just a good mental tickler to say, okay, let me make certain all my records are accurate as you work through your career.
Have you talked to people in the class that maybe heard you before and they accessed it, and then they said, I didn't even know I was these items that are in there are applicable to me? Would there be not a common denominator there, but would there be something that somebody needs to know but don't know that they need to know?
Well, I think most people, one of the things they should look for is to make sure their designation of beneficiary forms are in there. They should be in there, all except for the Thrift Savings Plan. Those are maintained by the Thrift Savings Plan. They're not in your official personnel folder. But those are the things that are part of your active employment that you should be paying attention to. So even if you're not thinking of retirement at this point, those records are key to when you get a promotion. How are they going to set your pay? If just something should happen to you, are your beneficiary designations current? Are they in there? And so all of those things are important as you're working through active employment, and they become even more important as you're getting to the point you're considering retirement.
Boots on the ground here. When you've counseled people while you were in federal service and certainly while you're out doing the seminars, are there some comments like, I didn't know I could do this, and they say that to you, and you think to yourself, you didn't know that?
Well, I'd say health benefits is the big one. As you get closer to retirement, you're going to be thinking about, how do I get that health insurance, which is such a valuable benefit? How do I get that over into the world of retirement? And the big factor for most people is meeting the five-year rule, meaning you must have continuous coverage by the FEHB, the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, some way, shape, or form, for the 5 years continuously before the day you retire. And that's the big item. When you get within that five-year scope of retirement, you want to be planning for that, for your health insurance or life insurance. Are you enrolled? And then do you have that continuous enrollment? But what many people don't realize is related to your health benefits, the five-year rule means that you could have your own enrollment. You could be covered by your spouse's enrollment. As long as it comes up to five continuous years, you don't have to be covered by the same carrier for 5 years or be on the same plan for 5 years. But if your agency can cobble together five continuous years of coverage, you're good to go to carry it into retirement. And also knowing that those 5 years might include if you're covered by the military's medical insurance, TRICARE, that time can count as long as you were going out the door, you're covered by an active FEHB enrollment. That's what puts together the 5 years of coverage.
When somebody looks to this, and maybe they were 5 years on, and then they took a sabbatical for however long, and then they came back, and maybe they did it again, does the individual get fuzzy with this? But more importantly, are the records accessible?
Well, here's the problem, and this is what I call the second part of the five-year rule, and most benefits specialists know this. It is the 5 years continuous coverage, but let's just say someone worked for a period of time and they had coverage, and they had at least, say, 3 years continuous before they left, separated from service, and they were out of service for a while, and they returned. Part two of the five-year rule says as long as you enroll immediately when you return to service into the FEHB program, that break in service doesn't count for the five-year rule. So if you had 3 years and you left and you came back and then you had an immediate 2 years, if you decided to retire at the end of those 2 years, you would meet the five-year rule. You wouldn't have to stay 5 years before you could separate. So it's important that people are aware of that, particularly in these times where people are coming and going from federal service at a more rapid rate than they used to years ago. So you want to be mindful of that. Have those records, especially if you're covered by your spouse's enrollment. Keep in mind that your own agency doesn't know that. They don't have reason to. You need to have that documentation from your spouse, from their agency's records, to include with yours, so they can use that to document coverage in that period of time. So that's why it's important to maintain, always make sure that your records are complete, particularly in the realm of your health benefits enrollment. They're either going to find those in the old hard copy forms, the election forms, or they're going to have to go into the payroll portal where you do your present enrollments during open season, where you elect your coverage. Those are kept there. So your agency is going to have to be looking in that venue for documentation, as well as into your OPF, your official personnel folder, to put together that 5 years of coverage. No matter when it occurs, they're going to have to be doing that to put together your history of enrollments.
So for somebody that maybe when they were in college and they had a summer position in an agency and the agency was happy to have them for the 3 months or so each summer for 4 years, does that help if they then become a career fed, if you will, once they graduate from school?
Yes, and it has the potential to count in one of two ways. It's either going to count to give them credit for earning annual leave, or it's going to count in both leave for leave purposes and retirement. And that's why it's so important to understand and appreciate your employment history as it relates to what we call creditable service for retirement, because some people are surprised to learn when they get to the point of retirement that possibly some of their service, even though it counts to earn them leave, isn't going to count in the world of retirement, and there may not be anything they can do about it to remedy that. That would be if they had a temporary appointment, which most summer appointments are. And if it occurred after January 1 of 1989, that particular amount of service is going to help them earn annual leave, but it is not going to count in their world of retirement, and they need to understand that difference. And that's why it's so important people attend seminars and become more knowledgeable of their employment history as to whether it's going to count toward retirement. Because if they have, let's just say, 3 months of a summer job, if they're thinking that's going to count to retirement, well, they're going to have a little bit of a surprise if that temporary job was after 1989, because it isn't going to count in their world of retirement to make them eligible or to add in the calculation of their benefit. So that's sometimes a big surprise for many people.
Yeah, many years ago in the summer, I worked for the SBA, looking at balance sheets and income statements relative to how the loan had benefited the company. It was actually kind of interesting, and then they took it off to the hill to show it good things they do, which they do. And at one point, I think it was maybe I had 3 summers of that, then I had some other work, and I worked in the post office. And I was close to the 5 years, and my father was talking to me about it, and I just said, no, you know, it was nice, but, you know, I want to go count beans for an accounting firm. Why? I'll never know, but that's what I did. But had I joined the Federal Service, would those have counted, those summers?
Indeed, they would. They would. And as I said, it depending upon the timing of that temporary job. If it occurred before 1989, although it wasn't covered by the retirement system because the law doesn't allow for that, if you are now in a position where you have retirement coverage under FERS or CSRS, you would have the ability to go back and bring that service into credibility for retirement purposes. But people need to know that. They need to understand it. Yes, it may help you gain more vacation time, but it isn't going to count in your world of retirement unless you do something about it. That's part of what I call the getting to go. Everything you should be looking at when you get before that five-year time. Do you have what we call potentially creditable service, that temporary time? Can you make that creditable? Maybe you have military time. Maybe you need to consider if you can make that count in your civilian retirement. So all of these things are factors people need to keep on their radar as they're getting within that five-year range. Because taking care of all those items, whether it's making a deposit or paying back the money you took as a refund from your contribution. All of that should be done before you get to 5 years out, because getting it done can take a considerable amount of time, and it only leads to hustle and bustle as you get closer to that actual retirement date. So the sooner you get it done, and it will actually cost you less if you're making a deposit or a redeposit by way of paying less interest in total, because you are going to pay the interest on those funds that they would have accrued had they been in the retirement fund the entire period of time of your service.
Okay, I think this is a good time for a break, and we've talked about benefits and the like, and the sponsor of the show, WAIPA, has an interesting way to join their group, if you will. So let's listen.
Life insurance is a conversation worth having. As a civilian federal employee, you have access to exclusive coverage from WAIPA, the life insurance choice of over 46,000 feds and their families. With WAIPA Group Term Life Insurance, you can apply for up to $1.5 million in portable coverage at a competitive price. Last year, the average fed who switched saved $375. WAIPA is a proud sponsor of For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, Mondays 10:05 to 11 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. WAIPA has been insuring the future of feds and their families for more than 75 years. To learn more about life insurance for feds by feds, visit waepa.org today.
All righty. Welcome back to For Your Benefit. We're here with Maureen Wilkin, federal benefits officer, retired Fed, current seminar presenter, and really knows her stuff with regards to federal benefits. And I was taking notes, but I gave up after a while. There were too many notes to take that I didn't understand. So where do we re-enter the discussion?
Well, we've talked about what people should be thinking of when they're 5 years or farther away from their actual plan date of retirement. And then there's other things they should be thinking about as well. People look at their annual leave yearly when we get to that use or lose point in time when people have to think about, do they have more annual leave than they're able to carry into the next leave year in federal service? But then they should start thinking about that as they get closer to retirement in terms of what we call the lump sum payment for the leave that you've not used for annual leave. So the same considerations go into planning for the year you're retiring as your regular leave year when you're actively employed. How much do you want to have? Do you want to get paid for that amount of leave you've not used, which will happen after you've separated, or do you want to use that? Because it isn't going to help you in terms of retirement. You just have to decide, do you want to get paid for it now and use that leave, or would you rather hold off and get paid for it when you've separated? Lots of things go into thinking about that. Do you need an extra day to make a month in the calculation of your annuity? And that will all go into, once you've had an annuity estimate, understanding how many hours you have and then when that's going to be paid out. Should you bump up your balance and get paid in the future because you're retiring at the end of the calendar and leave years so that you're going to get paid for that in the next tax year? This is your world, Bob. Are you going to get paid for that in next tax year, and it will cost you less in taxes? So you're going to have to start thinking about that. That's in terms of your annual leave, your vacation leave. But then you also need to think about your sick leave balance. We talked about that a little bit earlier in terms of making sure you know what that is if you separate. But when you're actively employed, you think, oh, well, I'll take a sick day here, a sick day there. But many people don't realize, yes, sick leave is your short-term disability insurance while you're federally employed, and you get to use that for sick leave purposes. But you all should be aware that you should be a good steward of that balance, because it's going to be converted from that hourly amount that you have into what we use for retirement calculation, years, months, and days. And they're going to take that total and add it to the amount of time you've actually worked when they calculate your annuity. So you'll get a bump up in your long-term annuity for being a good steward of that sick leave. So people need to appreciate that as they're working through their history and knowing that, yes, if I don't use it now, it will benefit me when I get to that point in time. And many people aren't aware of that. So it's important to understand how it actually works when they compute your benefit. It's going to add to that. It won't ever detract from it, and you won't ever lose the value for it, because it's only going to add into the calculation of your annuity that you'll have the remainder of your life.
So let me make sure I understand this and pretend that I'm a soon-to-be-retired Fed. So if I don't use the leave, I accumulate it. And when I do separate from federal service, I have the ability then to cash it in. But it also would then, include my federal service time?
So that, well, it's the difference between annual leave and sick leave. Annual leave, you're going to go, it's a cash out. You're going to get paid for that no matter when you separate, whether it's simply the leave service or when you're retiring. They're going to take the amount of hours, the number of hours that you have of annually vacation time, personal time off, as they call it in the private sector, and they're going to multiply those hours by the amount that you are earning on an hourly basis. So however much you earn, they convert it to an hourly rate, multiply that by the number of hours you have, and that's what you'll get paid in a lump sum payment. So that's your vacation time. But your sick leave is handled differently. If you're separating, it simply gets parked there for your use if you return to federal service. But if you never return, you left it behind. That's it. But when you're retiring, it's a different consideration where they'll take that balance and, again, convert it from hours into years, months, and days. That total will be added to the amount of time you've actually worked in your employment history for the federal government. And that total time is what they're going to use to compute your retirement benefit. So in the long run, it will benefit you, whether you use it in service, but probably even a greater benefit if you add to your time in retirement, because that's a long-term payment. That's going to stretch out over your entire retirement history.
So that could impact my annuity to be greater than what it would be if I didn't do it.
Absolutely. Even for those people who are covered by the original retirement, civil service retirement, even if they've maxed out, as we call it, if they've hit that 80% of their high three that they get once they hit 41 years and 11 months of service, they can't add any more to their annuity by way of service. However, their sick leave is still going to be added to that 41 years and 11 months to give them an even greater amount of their high three salary in their retirement benefit. So it benefits everyone, no matter which system you're covered by.
What else should they look for? I mean, this is like a treasure trove this morning. So are there other things that maybe you're teaching? When I teach, sometimes I think, well, I thought, you know, the group would know this. And I'd imagine it's probably more so with you with regard to the opportunities one has with benefits.
Right. Well, health benefits especially, when we talked about that five-year rule and you said you had to have that enrollment, many people think that the five-year rule also applies to their family members, their spouse, their children, whomever they have on their enrollments. But it does not. The five-year rule only applies to you, the employee, having an enrollment for those five consecutive years. It doesn't take into consideration how long your eligible family members have been covered. And that's very important for people who perhaps have only added their spouse or children within the last 2 or 3 years, and they're considering retiring within that five-year range. They don't need to worry about that. Their family members will still be covered even if they've had less than 5 years of coverage. So that's something people need to think about as well in terms of meeting that second consideration for carrying the benefit into retirement, meeting that five-year rule.
Okay, how about this? We got a couple, both federal employees, both with the ability to retire with years in service, et cetera. Are there things that one should look at and say, I'll do this because it's better for the both of us than if we both do the same thing?
Exactly. And it's really, really important if you're what I call a two-fed family, meaning you're both employed by the federal government. You're both retirement covered. You're earning your own benefit. Now, when you get to the point of filling out your paperwork and your application, you're going to have to think about, are you going to be considering to electing a survivor benefit for a surviving spouse? Now, in your world of estate planning and taxes, people think, well, what am I going to get, you know, and how much is this going to amount to at the end of the road? People who are a two-fed family, a couple needs to understand, if you're earning your own annuity, and if your spouse selects a survivor benefit for you to receive, no matter what the amount, they're still going to be eligible to keep that survivor benefit as well as their own earned annuity that they're earning by way of their own employment. It's not an either-or consideration in terms of survivor benefits under federal retirement. And that's completely different from what you're going to see in the world of Social Security. When in the world of Social Security, if you're both working and both earning your own workers' benefit, when either of you dies in a married couple, you're only going to get the higher of the two benefits, be it your own earned benefit or a survivor's benefit. You won't get to keep both. And that's a big thing for people to understand when they're considering whether they should elect the survivor benefit in the world of federal retirement, being a two-fed family. And the other thing is, if you're a two-fed family and you each have your own entitlement to FEHB, meaning you've had coverage for 5 years, and then you don't need to think about electing a benefit simply in order to provide continuation of health benefits for a surviving spouse. So there's other considerations for a two-fed family than if just one of the couple is a federal employee, and things they should be looking at in evaluating and running the numbers, so to speak. Like, if I elect this benefit and not that, then what will you have to live on if I die first? And then conversely, what if you die first? What will I have to live on? And that's the scenario that families should be running before they decide what they want to elect for their survivor benefits. Because once you have retired, you don't have a lot of flexibility in terms of changing those elections. So you really need to give it careful consideration before you get to the point where you're filling out your paperwork.
All right, let's say we've got a two-fed family. Both are eligible, have met the eligibility to retire. One wants to stay on, the other one doesn't. So if the one that doesn't leaves earlier than the other, are there any things that they lose by going out in advance of their mate?
So if they're just separating or retiring, well, there's two scenarios.
Oh, they're going to retire. They're going to retire.
Okay, so if one's going to retire before the other, well, they need to think about their health insurance, right? So if and age is a factor as well when we start talking about Medicare. You know, you get to that 65 and you're both considering retiring, who's carrying the insurance? And in terms of the tax benefit for the premium conversion, the person who's retired is going to lose that premium conversion or the ability to pay that premium out of pre-tax dollars. The person who's still actively employed keeps that because they're still actively employed paying a health benefits premium. So there's that consideration. And then there's the consideration of age. So that the person who is retiring, if they're the one carrying the enrollment and they're 65, as they're separating, that starts their 8-month clock for their special enrollment period for Medicare if they haven't already enrolled. So they have to think about that. And for the person who's still actively employed, if they're 65, they may have a surprise to realize because that insurance by which they are covered is now based in retirement, that will trigger their own 8-month special enrollment period, even though they're still working, because that insurance that they're covered by is now based in retirement. They're 65. They need to think about what they're going to do for Medicare.
Now, again, when you teach class or you talk to people after class, how many people know what you just said?
Very few.
I'm sitting listening to that and I say, wow, how many people know this?
Yeah, very few people. And it doesn't matter whether you're federally employed or privately employed. So you could have one couple, one working in the private sector, the other working for federal government or state government. It doesn't matter where they're working. The two factors for Medicare are you 65 and where is your insurance coming from at that point in your life? So you may be happily working. You may hit 65 and you think, well, I don't have to worry about that because I'm still working. But if your spouse has the insurance, maybe they've retired from the private sector, even if they're not 65, guess what? That insurance, when you're 65, is based in retirement, so you have to think about Medicare, even though you're still working. So the big factor about where's your insurance coming from when you're 65, that's the big one most people don't understand. They think that even though they're still working, they're okay. But the other bigger factor is, by what type of insurance are you covered when you reach age 65?
People must really appreciate this when you give them the answers. Do you ever consult with retiring federal employees before they retire and or after, outside of the classroom?
Well, just what I – no. I like to sleep at night, Bob, so I don't do that anymore, because I feel as though if I can't see their records, I really can't give them a full picture of what they need to think about. Because remember what I said at the outset, records are the final frontier. So many employees will come to a seminar and they have a particular question. But sometimes that isn't the question that they really need to ask, because when you ask them secondary questions following their initial question, they say, oh, but this is that, and it changes the whole perspective completely. So unfortunately, in the world of federal benefits, there's that one little question that needs to be asked that sometimes they don't even know that they have to ask. And only when you delve and look into their records and go into their employment history can you honestly get a full picture of what they have in place and what they may need to know beyond what they already know.
Very good. Well put. So, Andrew, why don't we run the NITP spot? I think this is a good time to listen to it, and then we'll be back, folks, in not too long a period of time.
Who do you trust when making your most important decisions? National Institute of Transition Planning has been the trusted source for federal retirement planning, serving new, mid-career, and pre-retirement federal employees for more than 30 years. NITP's subject matter experts bring more than 800 years of collective expertise on federal benefits, financial transition, and estate planning. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com to sign up for their free monthly newsletter and information about free webinars.
Does planning for retirement seem like a daunting task? Is retirement years away? It will arrive sooner than you think. Prepare now to stay on track. Join the thousands of federal employees and retirees who have already attended National Institute of Transition Planning's free monthly webinars to learn more about retirement and financial planning. NITP is the national leader and trusted source for federal retirement information. Visit NITPinc.com to sign up for NITP's free monthly newsletter and webinar.
Welcome back to the third of the three time slots, and we're talking about federal benefits today with Maureen Wilkin. Maureen is a federal benefits officer, retired, and fortunately fellow seminar presenter. I'm taking notes here, Maureen. I don't know that I'll understand it a day from now, but so in our final third, we've covered. I don't think we've covered everything. I think we didn't talk much. I know we talked a little bit about the retirement application process, when to retire, paperwork, and the like. Did we touch on that at the beginning?
Well, we touched on it briefly, but yeah, this is really when people begin to drill down, when they really start thinking about, they've picked a date, and everyone should pick a date. Even if you just started work, you should pick a date, because that's the thing that will keep you going. It will make you appreciate at what point you are in the timeline for retirement preparation. What I always emphasize to people in the FERS retirement system, and 90% of employees now are, that the date that they need to know, first of all, is what is their minimum retirement age. It's not the same for everyone, because it's based on the year in which you were born. Know that factor, because that factor is a key component into your earliest date for eligibility for most people. The earliest date most people could retire would be the option that uses the minimum retirement age plus at least 10 years of federal service. That's for most people the earliest date of eligibility. And once they've reached that, that's kind of like the insurance factor. Like, no matter what would happen after that point while you're employed, you would have an escape factor. You'd be able to separate, retire with a benefit, and more than likely keep your health insurance and life insurance if you meet the requirements for that, the 5 years and enrollment categories, and you'd be fine. So that would be your backup plan. hopefully you wouldn't have to use it, but you could use it, and that would be a great thing to know. So that's, for most agencies, actually, that's the date that they'll give someone when they ask for an annuity estimate. Like, what would happen if I wanted to retire? That's their earliest date of eligibility. And then beyond that would be the other options, say, at age 60 with at least 20 and so on. But knowing that earliest eligibility date, when is it you would reach that date? That's key in someone's history. And then as they work closer toward the date of actual retirement that they're thinking of, then they can start to think about, all right, what would be my maximum benefit if I left at this point? And then they need to, you know, back it up, think about their records, their enrollments for their benefits, and all those kinds of things. So they should start thinking about that in terms of a checklist format, right? I've done this. I've took care of my deposits, my redeposits. Do I have all my documents, my own copies? Is everything in my OPF that needs to be there? And that's key to getting an accurate estimate of your annuity, because having an incomplete employment history in your OPF isn't going to help you in any way, shape, or form, because that's the record that your agency is going to use to calculate an estimate of annuity for you. And that's key to your understanding what goes on as you move ahead in the application process. You'll get that estimate of annuity. You're going to file your paperwork with your agency. And from that point on, it rolls downhill to payroll and then eventually to the Office of Personnel Management. But you need to be sure that you've done everything you can do to expedite that process. If your records are incomplete, well, then you're going to get an incomplete estimate of annuity. And then when your records get to OPM, someone at OPM is going to have to go to the record center and find those records you're saying that you should have to your credit. That's only going to delay you getting out of what we call interim pay, those first few months where you're actually retired. That's when you're going to receive 80% of what your agency's annuity estimate showed you should receive as a full benefit. That's not a good place to be, because that's 80% of an incomplete estimate, and you're really going to be getting less than what you anticipate until you reach the point where you get into regular annuity status. And then they're going to make up the difference in pay, but in the interim period, which could be a good 5 months or more, you're not going to be getting your complete income you had anticipated. And that is not a good place to be when you initially retire.
Okay. And talking about retiring, and we mentioned CSRS folks and CSRS offset, a small percentage of the retiring probability pool. But they have something, CSRS as well as CSRS offset. And correct me if I'm wrong here, it's called the Voluntary Contribution Program. When you initially,
yes.
When you initially hear that, it sounds like this is going to be a charitable donation. It's quite the opposite. but you would be doing yourself a favor to do this, because, again, you tell me where I'm off kilter here. An individual could put up to 10% of their federal lifetime earnings into this thing called the Voluntary Contribution Program. At that point,
exactly.
They,
this is for CSRS only. Yes.
Yeah, and the offsets, right?
And offset as well. Exactly. Yes.
But
as long as you don't owe an outstanding deposit or redeposit, you're able to have one of these accounts. Is basically what it is. It is a bank account that's maintained by the Office of Personnel Management, into which you can contribute, as you said, up to 10% of your career earnings. Career earnings, not just the most recent year of pay, and it can be a considerable amount of money. Now, the difference between this and the TSP, the dollars you're putting into this account are after-tax dollars. It's not like pre-tax in the world of TSP. So it's after-tax, and you can contribute this in one payment or whatever. You do it directly with the Office of Personnel Management. To establish these accounts, you need to reach out to your HR benefits function, because there's a form to be completed which you will sign, and they will send to the Office of Personnel Management. And from that point on, it's a matter of business between you and OPM how much you wish to put in this account. When you reach the point of retirement, you must take the money from this account, and you have several options to do the money with this money. One is to purchase additional annuity. The other, you could roll it into an IRA. And in your world of taxes, Bob, this is like benefits bingo. This is great for people under CSRS. So if you don't have any knowledge of this, there's a great bit of information on the OPM.gov website. If in the search box you just type in voluntary contribution, you'll go to a link where it'll explain the program and then what your options are as you're coming into retirement, what you can do with that money. If you have additional disposable income, it's a great way to save dollars, put money in this account. This account is earning in this year 2.25% interest. That's a pretty good rate. You're not going to get that in most CDs at this point in time unless you give them your firstborn. So it's something, if you are in CSRS, it's a wonderful opportunity if you have additional money to contribute above and beyond. Because remember, these are after-tax dollars, but you can roll them into an IRA. So it's something for you to look at in terms of your overall strategy for tax savings. And that's where I get out of the money line, Bob. That's your world.
Okay. Now, it's not any IRA. It's a Roth IRA. So
exactly.
How good is this? And I don't care what the amount is. Some are saying, "Gee, I don't have as much of as I'd like." Whatever you have, I don't know of anything like it in the private sector. I'm sure there is, but
no,
I'm
there's not. Not. And it's the fact that it earns a variable rate of interest, and it changes every year. This year's is 2.25%. You're not going to find anything like this. And it's interesting, in these accounts, you're earning the same rate of interest that people who are paying into the retirement fund are paying. So you're the people paying their deposits and redeposits are really funding the earnings to be made in these accounts for people with voluntary contribution accounts.
All righty. The non-CSRSers are getting tired of listening to this because it's such a good deal.
They have their TSP matching. So.
Okay. So that's one of the great benefits. There are many benefits to being a federal employee, but that one financially, if you can afford to do so. But again, it doesn't have to be the full 10% of your entire career earnings. It could be whatever you have.
Exactly. And I had to think of it in terms of if you're doing catch-up contributions in the world of TSP, you know, you can do up to the maximum this year. I think it's $6,000, but you don't have to do the full amount. Whatever you can do between $1 and that full amount is perfectly fine, and people need to think of it in the same context.
All righty, so we're coming down to the window where we have our retirement application, and we're treading lightly because we don't know that we really want to do it. But if we're preparing, are there things that people maybe leave out that they were unaware of, that they had to put in, or it was detrimental to them because they didn't put it in?
Well, I always recommend that if anyone has made a military service deposit whereby they take their military service and bring it into federal service history by way of making a military service deposit, make sure that in your application you include a copy of the paid-in-full receipt, because even though it should have been documented in payroll, I've seen it happen where somebody didn't do the final step. Having that documentation go to OPM is a clear signal to them that you've made the deposit, and they're going to look for that. Even though it's also documented by the agency's portion of the application paperwork, it never hurts to put it in just to be sure. You know, that as the man said, trust but verify. Make sure you put your copy in there, especially for people who are under CSRS that might be have that catch 62 consideration. You want to make sure they see that record. And if it's not part of payroll, then they'll see on your side that you had the paid in full receipt. And that's key to making sure that you don't get dinged for not having paid that deposit if you're under CSRS. So it's very important for people under CSRS, equally as well for people under FERS. For people under FERS who have made civilian deposits, for a deposit or redeposit, on your application, they're going to ask you for a copy of that account number. So you need to go back to your paid in full receipt from OPM and get that account. It's called a CSD number. You'll see it right on the statement. They want you to put that on your applications, and then they'll pull up your records to verify you've completed the deposit or redeposit. If you don't have a copy of that paid in full receipt, there's a simple way to get one from OPM. You simply send an email to retire@opm.gov or just at retire@opm and say, I made my deposit or redeposit. I never get a paid in full receipt. And they'll come back to you. Don't put all your PII in that email, all right? Say, I made my deposit or redeposit, and then they're going to come back to you and ask you for something. but send that email to retire@OPM in order to get that paid in full receipt that reflects your account number that's required on your application. Another bit of information that will expedite the processing. If they don't have the number, they're going to have to dig to find it. So you want to do everything on your side to expedite your application. That's key. And again, as I said, the documentation, if you were covered by your spouse's FEHB enrollment, give that to your agency before you're turning in your paperwork so they have the ability to put together your 5 years of continuous coverage. All of those things should be in place. Then when you're going to fill out your paperwork, you can find the application online. It's not a state secret. If you go to opm.gov, at the very top of the page, you'll see a bunch of tabs, and one of those is for forms. Simply click on it, and you want to get to the standard forms, and you'll find the applications to retire. CSRS is the standard form 2801. FERS is 3107. They're out there, so read them ahead of time. And by all means, read the instructions, and then hold on to those instructions because they have very good information related to next steps, especially in terms of electing a survivor benefit. What happens if I change my mind? Who do I call? Who do I contact? What do I need to do? Things you're going to want to hold on to once you've submitted that paperwork to your agency.
So in working with folks, if you were to say the top 3, 4, or 5 things that people didn't know to fill out, I mean, not that the application.
The tax form.
Okay.
Sometimes the agency forgets to give them the IRS form. It's the IRS form W-4P. It's for federal tax holding from annuities, all right? And you're going to need to submit that with your application because if they don't get one, the default withholding for federal taxes is going to be married with 3 exemptions. And if that's not what you want, you better be sure that you submit the W-4P. And then over time, you can always change that directly through OPM, through their online services portal, and you'll have access to that once you've retired. But initially, you need to put that in place for your annuity. It's very important that you get that done. State tax, they won't withhold until you reach regular annuity status, and then you can implement that again by way of the retirement services online. Do that directly with OPM.
Your point about married with 4 exemptions, the default, for somebody that's not married, that's going to put them behind because their withholding generally is larger than somebody that's married, all things considered, and can be in the
exactly.
same.
Exactly. Now,
sides.
They'll say, and you'll see it on the application, it clearly tells you that if you don't submit one, this is what the default will be. But you know, people don't always read instructions, and they don't pay attention. So do yourself a favor and make sure that whatever you wish at the outset of your annuity to be withheld, you have that on the W-4P. Otherwise, they're going to the default, which is it'll show you on the application is married with 3 exemptions.
So as I'm listening to you, and excuse me if I've already asked you this, is there like a top 2, 3, or 4 things that you find in talking with the classes where they go, I didn't know that?
They don't know who to contact, first of all. Who do you submit your application to? And that's key. So I always recommend people at least 6 months before you're going to retire. Start finding out through your agencies, your HR function, who do I need to work with if you haven't already started at that point? Who should I submit the paperwork to? And when do they want it by? That's the other key factor. Depending upon what point in the year you're retiring, your agency is going to want your paperwork sooner rather than later, especially at that end of the calendar year when they're so busy. They might even ask you to submit that in July. But always remember, as I tell people, if something comes your way and you have to change your mind and you determine you can't retire, you can always pull back that paperwork up until the day you walk out the door. And actually, you can do it beyond, but you won't get back in your agency because they've already separated you. But never hesitate to take it back. Even if your agency says they've started to fill your position, you have the ability to say, I'm sorry, my life has changed, I have to stay working. And that's perfectly fine. You have every right to do that.
But they don't necessarily are guaranteed to stay at the agency and at the position. They might have to go within the agency or outside the agency. Am I hearing that?
Well, your agency is going to have to keep you because you've decided not to separate. But what they decide to reassign you or whatever, that's within their purview. But in terms of your having to retire, retirement is the only voluntary personnel action. Only you can retire you unless you've been removed for some reason. But you are the one who initiates that by way of your application. It isn't your supervisor or your manager who retires you. Your application triggers that action, and if you decide to reverse that, it's certainly within your purview to take it back.
Okay, Andrew just said you have 2 minutes. It's like a sports game. This is a two-minute drill.
It's a two-minute drill. I'm not as good as Joe Montana, but I would say I would tell people, don't wait. Don't hesitate. Make sure your records are complete no matter where you are in your employment history, because you may just walk out the door and you'd want to make sure your history is accurate. Make sure you have all your getting to go done, your deposits, your redeposits. Think about voluntary contributions if you're CSRS. No matter what you're covered by, be mindful of your health benefits and your life insurance elections. Are you going to be able to be carrying those into retirement? And know that for your health insurance and your life insurance, those don't change when you get into retirement. Your benefits remain the same. In retirement, you'll pay the same for health insurance as you did as an active employee, just without pre-tax consideration. So there's lots to think about, but don't delay. Time can be your friend, but time can be your enemy if you delay.
Okay, I thought you were an Eagles fan.
I'm really non-committal when it comes to the world of football.
Okay, all righty. The Eagles fans are—they're a different breed of cat. They are true fans. Anyway, that's not
dyed in the wool.
Okay, good. All righty. I think we're about done. Andrew says you're going to be cut off if you don't get off. So Maureen, thanks for coming on, and I hope people were taking notes.
Happy trails, happy planning for retirement, and even better retirement after that.
Okay, thanks once again, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WEPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.